has got a life filled with all kinds of experiences. And at this point in his life that we're studying tonight, we begin with chapter 27 of 1 Samuel. He is going to go to the Philistines and pretend at least to be a part of their group because he's tired of running away from Saul, and he's probably experiencing a real down moment in his life. 1 Samuel chapter 27 verse 1, "Then David said to himself, 'Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will disappear of searching, of searching for me any more in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand.'" So why did David escape into the land of the Philistines? He figured it was about his only alternative at this point. He had tried to stay clear of him, and he'd had some very narrow escapes, but he's going to put himself in a position where he thinks that he'll not be bothered by Saul. Why would he be welcomed by the Philistines?
Well, he didn't kill Goliath, so he's, you know, they're a warrior, so he's looked on highly.
He's got a reputation, doesn't he? And the reputation is one that the Philistines are very familiar with, and they're probably thrilled to death to think that somebody who has been fighting against them is going to come and join their ranks.
Plus, the Philistines might also think the enemy of my enemy would be okay. So, yeah, if David was the enemy of Saul, and Saul was the enemy of the Philistines, maybe it wouldn't be so bad that everyone
else. Sure. Very good. Why was it wrong for David to go to the Philistines?
They weren't Jewish.
Well, that's true. And also, does he know what his future holds?
Yeah, he knows he's going to be king.
Yes. And you don't be a king of a nation that you flee away from. You need to kind of keep in contact with that nation. And this has been made clear to him by the prophet Gad, that he should stay in the land of Judah, but he is for a moment not there. He had fled on a previous occasion, you remember, down to the land of Moab. The fact that he doesn't go down to Moab, well, let me ask the next question here. Why did David not flee to Moab as he had done previously? And of course, any answer we give is going to be a guess, but you have to think that maybe he wasn't that content down there, and maybe they weren't as friendly as that he thought they might be, or were not as protective as they could have been. Obviously, we do not know. From a human standpoint, did it appear that David was desperate?
Yeah.
I think so.
Tired of running.
I think so. When you get tired and you've just worn out and you wonder, is it ever going to end, you begin to make some decisions that probably you wouldn't have made under other circumstances. Verse 2, please.
So David arose and crossed over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maon.
All right, is Achish the same man mentioned in 21:11? The man mentioned in 21:11 by this same name is acknowledged to be Achish, the king of Moab. So probably it is the same person. The only reason I ask that is when you read commentaries, some of them will say, this is probably a different person. Others will say, no, it's probably the same person. So there's not agreement on this. That's the reason I thought I would ask. Verse 3, David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. Now what is suggested by the mention of each with his household?
There's more than 600 if you've got the whole family.
Yes, so David is concerned not only about the men that have joined with him, but their families, their wives and children. So they're going to be along with him also. Now, why did Achish welcome David and his men with their families?
Strengthens his position.
Yeah, I think so. I think that he sees here's an opportunity for us to have a lot of extra help. And, of course, they're still intent on doing more battle against the army of King Saul, and they will be doing that, as we find as we continue on in our study. Verse 4, please.
I was told, Saul, now it was told, Saul, that David had fled to Gath. So he no longer searched for him.
All right, what does this verse tell us about Saul?
He was afraid of him.
He's not about to fight the Philistines, isn't he? Is he? He's given up on trying to get David. He had learned that David is a man that was able to stay clear of him. And obviously now that he's gone into enemy territory, he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. Does this end Saul's search for David? As far as we know, it does. Then David said to Achish, "Now if I have found favor in your sight, let them give me a place in one of the cities of the country, that I may live there, for why should your servant live in the royal city with you?" Now, did David want to live in Gath?
No,
I think not. Did David deem it important to keep his people away from the corruption of pagan culture? I think that's a part of the reason, too, that he wants to get into another area. What reasons did David give for requesting another place for them to live?
Trying to butter him up by saying, "Hey, you're royal city. Why should I be in your royal city?"
Oh, I think you're exactly right. David, you know, is being very diplomatic in this, and he wants to protect his men. He wants to have safety, but he's going to engage in some activity that he doesn't want the king of the Philistines to know about. So this is all working out to his benefit that the king is agreeing to help him out here. Verses 6 and 7, please.
So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. The number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months.
All right, now the city of Ziklag was located about 15 miles southeast of Gaza and about 25 miles southwest of Gath. So it's about 12 miles in the northeasterly direction from Beersheba. Now, perhaps that's the best definition I can give for you, because you all remember that the Holy Land is described as far as the north to the south. And what are the two cities we think of in those?
Dan and Beersheba.
Dan and Beersheba. And Beersheba's clear to the south. So we're just north of Beersheba, where Ziklag is located. Did Ziklag give David independence?
Yes.
Well, yes, it did. It was far enough away from Saul's jurisdiction and also away from Achish, and they could be by themselves. Now, according to this verse, how long did David and his men live here in Ziklag?
1 year and 4 months.
All right, 16 months altogether. The question may be not worded very well in your printed paper there, number 4. What was probably true about Ziklag that made it a suitable place for David and his men to live?
It's on the frontier.
Okay,
sure. So they could raid other places. And
yes. And that's exactly what they're going to do, as we read on ahead. And it's in Philistine territory, so he's safe there. It's an area that is relatively uninhabited, and so he's free there to do what he wants to do without being observed too much. What ultimately came to be true of Ziklag? It became whose possession?
Judah.
That's right. It became a part of Judah, the kings of Judah. Now, why did Achish receive David and his men? Obviously, he is given a large boost in his army. Going to be a sizable force for any enemy to deal with. And he knew that David was the arch enemy of Saul. And so David is known for his greater military skill than Saul. So for these reasons, perhaps others you can think of, Achish is glad to have David and his men.
Be a buffer zone, too, like the Soviet Union after World War II built the Eastern Bloc. Iron Curtain had a buffer zone in all those countries before the motherland.
Sure. Excellent. Very good. All right, verse 8.
And David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and the Gizurites and the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times. They should come to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt.
All All right, is what is meant by the words went up? All right, this could be geography. That's exactly right. Or it could be this is the where they're going to start a battle. So they went up to fight, and so the up may be a geographic indication, and it may not be. Now, this area, this geographic area we're talking about here now, is the area where the children of Israel wandered around the wilderness. You remember when they crossed the Red Sea, and then because they did not believe that God was going to deliver what he had promised, God allowed them, that generation of people, to die off while they were wandering around the wilderness. We're talking about that particular area. This is the area south of Judah and north of Egypt. Now, who were these people that David raided?
The ancient inhabitants of the time. They're, I think they're one of Noah's son's descendants.
Okay, these are Israel's enemies. That's the primary thing to keep in mind. And these are the people that had been originally ordered to have exterminated. I remember back in the time of Joshua that to get rid of all these people and had not done so. Shur is on the border of Egypt. That's where that is located. Now, were these raids carried out without bothering Achish?
Yes.
Yes. He doesn't even need to know anything about it, but he'll learn about it as David will inform him in the way in which David wants him to be informed. All right, verse 9.
David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive, and he took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing. Then he returned and came to Achish.
All right, does it appear that David's agreement with Achish was to pay a kind of tribute to him each time they brought back plunder? Could be very likely, isn't it, in what we read here. Were the people David attacked completely destroyed?
Yes.
All right, verse 10, please.
Now, Achish said, "Have you made a raid today?" And David said, "Against the Negev of Judah and against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites and against the Negev and of the Kenites."
All right, what may be said about David's report to Achish? He's making a kind of report that's worded in a way that would cause Achish to think that he's attacking Israelite territory. Actually, he's not in Israelite territory, but it's worded in such a way that the king is going to think that. What was the Negev?
A desert.
A desert, a very dry area, and there was very little water. Very few streams in this particular area where this was located. The Negev would be in the area close to Beersheba. Where was the Negev in of Jerahmeel? This would be south of Beersheba. The Negev of the Kenites would be the area close to Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem. David did not leave a man or a woman alive to bring to Gath, saying, "Otherwise they will tell about us, saying, so has David done, and so is his practice at all times, all the time he has lived in the country of the Philistines." Why did David then leave no survivors? That's right. He wanted to be the only one that was able to report what had happened to the king. Had David been given the same mandate by God as was given to Joshua?
It sounds like that. It's a book to all the people there.
All right, we do not have any record that that was given to him. So that is an assumption that people may make, but it's not something we can say definitely that was true. However, it is true that many of these people that are being killed are those that should have been killed before this time. Was the kind of barbarity David practiced unusual in those days?
No.
No, it wasn't. Unfortunately, David did not arise above the practice of some of his contemporaries. Verse 12, please.
So Achish believed David, saying, he surely made himself odious among his people Israel, therefore he will become my servant forever.
Was Achish convinced of David's loyalty to him?
Yes.
Yes, he was. Did David's conscience bother him when he deceived Achish about his activities? Well, Matthew Henry, in his commentary, believes that it did bother him, and he believes it on the basis of Psalm 119, verse 29, where he words, remove from me the way of lying. So, does this figure in what we're talking about tonight? Perhaps it does. At least that is one point of view. What may be said about the chronology of the final chapters of 1 Samuel? Thing that this is really not a fair question to ask you unless you've done some research on this. This covers quite a lengthy period of time, so we don't have a very much detail about this particular period, but the time element is really not stressed. Josephus tells us that it was a period of about 22 years that is being covered in these final chapters of this book.
But the killing off of these people is partly also because they were idol worshippers. Would the killing off of all these people would be partly because they were idol worshippers?
Oh, because they were idol worshippers. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. And, yeah.
Because when you think about it, that
My notes are all mixed up here tonight. That's the reason I'm delaying in some of my questioning here. All right, that chapter 27, right? 27. I thought we did that. Where did I get this? I'll find out where I am here in a minute. I don't know why I got my pages all mixed up.
Just for the record, I'm not the one who messed up your notes.
Okay, I put a page clear at the bottom that I shouldn't have, and so that's my problem. Sorry about that. All right, verse 1 of chapter 28, please.
Now it came about in those days that the Philistines gathered their armed camps for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, now assuredly that you will get out with me in the camp, you and your men.
All right, those days refer to the days that David was at Ziklag with his men. Now, why did Achish think that this was the time to strike against Israel?
Because he didn't know any different.
Sure. He knows that there's been a general dissatisfaction among the people of Saul, and he knows that with the absence of David, he's got extra force on his side. David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what your servant can do. So Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. Was David's reply to Achish ambiguous?
Yes.
Yes, it certainly was. Did Achish regard David's answer as ambiguous?
No.
No. He assumed he was being told the truth. Can we justify David's actions at this time?
Well, you hand in the line notes, you take time to take it out.
I'm still still having trouble finding pages. Oh, here it is up here. Okay. Verse 3.
Well, Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritualists.
All right. By the way, that word spiritus is not the same as spiritual. It's spirit. Spiritus, not spiritualist. So there is a distinction, just so we don't get confused here.
Seance people.
I'm sorry?
Seance people, right?
Yes, that's right. It's a whole group of people that are involved with the demonic powers and are opposed violently by God. Why are we reminded again that Samuel was dead? Purpose here is to let us know that Saul really had no other place to go. He knows that he's not in good stead with God. He knows that he has been responsible for the death of a lot of the priests. He knows that Samuel's not around, so where is he going to go? Now, why had Saul removed all the mediums and spiritists?
Probably told him things he didn't want to know.
You're putting a good spin on it. That's interesting. Was there a time in Saul's life that he really did behave like a man ought to behave?
Yes.
And there's a time that he was right with God, and I think it was during that time that he realized that this is not the Lord's will, and so he took action to have them expelled. So, who were mediums? What makes a person a medium? Yes, they're kind of a middle person. They're able to make a contact with the dead to inquire of them. And who were the spiritists?
I want the same thing, except they talk to spirits.
Same thing, except they're not necessarily limited to being able to talk with the dead, but they are known for their knowledge of the spirit world, and that they had contact with the demons, and they could gain information that would not be available except in their special insight as spiritists. Verse 4, please.
So the Philistines gathered together and came and camped in Shunem, and Saul gathered all Israel together, and they camped in Gilboa.
By the way, this Shunem is a very important place. You may remember that Elisha and Gehazi, his servant, were guests in the home of a prominent woman who lived in Shunem. And one day, Elisha decided that he ought to do something real nice for this lady. And he found out that she was without any family, though she was married. And he said to her, after they had been entertained in their home, "Next year when I come back, you will have a son." And she said, "You don't know what you're talking about." But he did know what he's talking about. And this was also the woman that said to her husband, "You know, we really enjoy having Elisha and Gehazi staying with us. We need to add a room onto our home." And so they added a room onto their home, and they furnished it with a bed and a table and a lamp and a chair, and were just happy to entertain them. So this is that same Shunem. Now, when we talk about Shunem and Gilboa, we're talking about the plain of Esdraelon, the valley of Jezreel. It's that area that is pretty prominent in the minds of people that believe that the final battle of the ages, Battle of Armageddon, is going to be fought in that piece of geography over there, that acreage, which is obviously not true. But this area was known for their many battles. A lot of wars were fought here. So the separation between Shunem and Gilboa was about 5 miles, and the place where both armies assembled was known as a battlefield, often referred to as the Plain of Esdraelon. How far were the Philistines from their home? They would have been about 45 miles north of the northernmost Palestinian city, or the Philistine city, I should say, about 45 miles away from their homeland. Now, why did Saul gather his army at Gilboa? This would have been a good vantage point for them to see and observe any movement of the enemy, and it would give them an advantage, they believed, in responding to the threats that they were about to face. Would you read verses 5 and 6, please?
Now,
When Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or urns or by prophets.
All right, why was Saul afraid?
Large army.
That's right. And you can be terrified by the mere size of an enemy. Did his lack of communication with the Lord contribute to his fear?
Yes.
Probably so. What were the normal ways of the Lord to communicate with his people at this time?
Dreams.
Dreams or by prophets or by the Urim. And this, of course, was... I'm sorry?
What is that?
This is... I don't know. But it is a device that was used by the priests, the Urim and the Thummim, that were beneath the breastplate, that was a means whereby God would make known to the priests what they needed to know. I wish I could give you a definitive answer on that. I wish that I had a book that gave me a definitive answer. I observed that a lot of people just kind of guess, but nobody seems to know for sure.
It didn't click to me when I read it here, but here you said the Urim and the Thummim.
Yeah.
I remember I've read about that.
You need to Google that.
It was a part of the breastplate of the priest, the high priest.
Joseph Smith said he took the Urim and Thummim and made peepstone spectacles out of them, and that's how he read the golden plates.
We appreciate that jewel that's just been shared with us. For the sake of anybody that's going to be listening to this, you need to know that we do not have a false prophet among us. We jest. All right, verse 8, please. Am I wrong? Verse 7, I'm sorry.
Paul said to his servant, "Seek for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servant said to him, "Behold, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor."
All right, why did Saul request a woman?
Because he was scared.
I'm sorry?
More often.
He was afraid, and he wanted some guidance of some kind, and the Lord didn't speak to him, so then he...
Yeah. Why would he not have contacted a man?
Mostly women who do those kind of readers are readers.
Kill most of them, and priests too are readers. There's nothing to choose from anyway.
Okay. It's surprising that any are still alive because he had previously ordered that all of them should be put to death. What is the folly of Saul's desire to inquire of a medium?
Of the Lord.
Yeah.
He's not supposed to go to him.
He
knows that. It's against the law.
Yeah.
Against his own law.
Right.
Can you back up just a, why do you think he chose a woman over a male medium?
I personally think he's pretty sure that all the men were killed that were mediums.
Okay.
Yeah.
The jokester in me wants to say because the men were large, they weren't mediums, but... I'm sorry, but it was a legitimate question in spite of my...
But the women were usually right?
I think we need to move on to another topic here. Endor was about 4 miles south of Mount Tabor. This is in the general vicinity of this battlefield where he has gone to make inquiry. Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes and went, he and his two men with him. And they came to the woman by night, and he said, "Conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you." Now, why did Saul disguise himself?
He knew this thing was wrong. She would have
asked him. Yes, he knows that this is wrong, and he doesn't want anybody to know his identity.
Well, she's a sign of weakness to his troops and stuff, that he's running off to something he's fallen for, that he's so scared that he's running off to these things that he said are relevant before and so scared.
You know, there are some who believe that this medium was the mother of Abner. That can't be proved. I found that very interesting that it was even suggested, but Anyhow, there's a lot about this that we don't know, except that he made inquiry of somebody he should not have. 1 Chronicles 10, 13, and 14 gives some insight here. He said, Saul died for his trespass, which he committed against the Lord because of the word of the Lord, which he did not keep, and also because he asked counsel of a medium, making inquiry of it, and did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom to David, the son of Jesse. So this is 1 Chronicles 10, 13, and 14 that adds this footnote to what we're reading here concerning his visit to the medium. He had to go about 7 or 8 miles in order to be where the medium was. This meant that he had to go pretty close to the place where the Philistines were encamped. He had to go around the outer skirts of where they were encamped to get to where the medium was. Verse 9, please.
But the woman said to him, Behold, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off those who are mediums and spiritists from the land. Why are you then laying a snare for my life to bring about my death?
All right, did the woman admit or deny that she possessed the power to do what Saul had asked?
No.
Neither one, that's right. Verses 10 and 11, please.
Saul called to her by the Lord, saying, As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Then the woman said, Whom shall I bring up for you? And he said, Bring up Samuel for me.
All right, what did Saul have to do before the woman would acknowledge that she was a medium? All right, he invoked the name of God in doing this, did he not? Very interesting that he should do this. How did the woman acknowledge that she professed the power to call up spirits from beyond the grave? Yeah, who do you want me to bring? I'll bring him up, whoever it is. And so who did Saul want to hear from? Samuel. When the woman saw Saul, Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman spoke to Saul, saying, Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. Now, did Samuel really appear? Yes, the scriptures say that. How did the medium know it was Saul who was standing before her?
Clear sight then, I guess.
Probably made a logical decision, didn't she, on the spur of the moment. I think she's as shocked as Saul was at this happening. But
it could have been part of the power, too, is recognizing, the spirit or something. I don't think someone has to be dead or be able to recognize something like that.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different suggestions that are made. One suggestion is made that his presence brought about a countenance and a brilliance and a light in the room, and the way in which he appeared and looked, he is readily recognized for who he really was. Some people explain the appearance of Samuel as being similar to the appearance of Moses and Elijah at the Mount of Transfiguration.
The dead could have also told him.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So that question, you just have to say, don't know, because it doesn't really explain.
That's true. That's right. Did the woman claim she saw Samuel, or did she actually see Samuel?
She saw him.
The record says that she saw him. That's right. Very good. What indicates that the woman had not expected to see Samuel?
She's surprised.
Yeah, she is surprised. Exactly. Now, does this experience prove the power of mediums?
No.
No, it proves the power of God, doesn't it? The very opposite here. Does the Bible say that the woman recognized Samuel, or that she saw Samuel?
She saw Samuel.
Who did she recognize?
Saul,
right. Verse 13, please.
The king said to her, Do not be afraid. But what do you see? And the woman said, Saul, I see a divine being coming up out of the earth.
Is one who is afraid telling another one who is afraid not to be afraid? Obviously they are. What did the medium see?
A divine being.
We'll leave it at that.
Verse
Verse 14.
He said to her, "What is his form?" And she said, "An old man is coming up, and he is wrapped with a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and did homage.
What did the spirit look like to the medium?
An old man.
An old man, right. Did Saul know who it was from the medium's description?
Yes.
Yes, he did. How did Saul react to the presence of Samuel?
Paid homage.
Yes, he gave great respect to him. Is there any reason to doubt that the spirit of Samuel appeared in the house of the medium on this night?
No.
Not at all. Why did the Lord permit Samuel to reappear on this occasion?
He sought to know exactly where he stood as far as God is concerned.
I'm not sure I heard you.
He wanted to make Saul know where he stood as far as his fate is concerned, right? What God is going to do with it.
Okay, it obviously is giving God an opportunity here to show his superiority to the mediums. And it also confirms the fact that there is life beyond the grave. Verse 15, please.
Samuel said to Saul, "Why hast thou disquiet me to bring me up?" And Saul answered, "I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me. And God is departed from me, and answereth me no more, neither by prophets or by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest know unto me what I shall do. Make known unto me what I shall do."
All right, did Samuel and Saul have a conversation without the mediation of the medium?
Yes.
Apparently they did. What does Samuel's initial question suggest? Yeah. I was getting along well until you came along, and I wish you hadn't bothered me. Does Saul respond to Samuel with a confession of his sin?
No.
No, he doesn't. Is Saul crying out for mercy?
Yes.
No, he isn't. I don't think. Do you see a cry for mercy?
No, he's complaining.
No, he's crying for information.
Yeah, okay. Not for mercy. Is this verse an example of an instance in which God uses an uncommon means of communication?
Yes.
Yes, very much like Hebrews 1:1. Anybody know what Hebrews 1:1 says? In Hebrews 1:1, the Hebrew writer is saying, in these last days, God communicates through His Son. But in days before, He communicated in a variety of ways. In dreams, and in many portions, in many different ways. And this is one of the ways in which God is communicating in days before. Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary? The Lord has done accordingly as He spoke through me. For the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, to David." Does Samuel rebuke Saul?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Did the Lord have anything to say to Saul through Samuel that had not already been said?
No.
No, he didn't. Would an evil spirit impersonating Samuel have ever said these words?
No.
Not at all. What is revealed in verse 17 that was not revealed back in 1 Samuel 13:14? And the thing that was not revealed in 13:14 of 1 Samuel was the name. But here, the name of Saul's successor is being given. And so he's indicated that David is going to be a successor. Verses 18 and 19, please.
"As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute His fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines."
All right, does the guilt of the king also involve the nation in punishment?
Yes.
Certainly does. Where will Saul and his sons be the next day? They're going to be in the abode of the dead, aren't they? What brought on all this trouble? The fact that Saul did not totally destroy the Amalekites that we read about back in chapter 15. What would have happened? What would happen to the army of Israel the next day?
They
they were going to be overtaken.
That's right, by the Philistines. Then Saul immediately fell full length upon the ground and was very afraid because of the words of Samuel. Also, there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day and all night. So what effect did these shocking words of Samuel have on Saul?
Dramatic.
Really filled him with terror, didn't it? And took away his appetite and took away his strength. Verses 21 and 22, please.
A woman came to Saul and saw that he was terrified and said to him, "Behold, your maidservant has obeyed you, and I have taken my life in my hand and have listened to your words which you spoke to me. So now also, please listen to the voice of your maidservant, and let me set a piece of bread before you that you may eat and have strength when you go on your way."
All right, was the behavior of the woman normal in these circumstances? Sure. Concern for his well-being. What caused the woman to want to help Saul?
Fear for her life.
Yeah. She knew who he was now. And yeah, she is concerned about herself and what he might do on this occasion under these circumstances.
She may not have wanted him to die in her business.
Yeah.
That would raise a lot of questions she'd have to answer.
Yeah. Verse 23, please.
But he refused and said, "I will not eat." But the servant, together with the woman, compelled him, and he hearkened not to their voice. So he arose from the earth and sat upon the bed.
All right, Saul initially refused to eat. What changed his mind?
His companions.
Yeah, the power of persuasion. The servants and the woman together joined up and finally convinced him that he needed to eat something. The woman had a fattened calf in the house, and she quickly slaughtered it. She took flour, kneaded it, and baked unleavened bread from it. She brought it before Saul and his servants, and they ate. Then they arose and went away that night. Was it unusual for animals to be kept close by to be used when meat was needed?
No.
Not unusual. Why was unleavened bread served?
Quicker,
okay. Do all the transactions of this chapter take place on one night?
It took a while to do all that. It said the same night.
Yes, it does. Is there a diversity of opinion regarding the correct understanding of the experience with the medium? Yes, there is. Just a lot of different opinions expressed here. Now, looking at verse 24... I have a problem with this. I don't disbelieve it. I just find it difficult. When you think about, then they arose and went away that night. The woman had a fattened calf in her house. She quickly slaughtered it. Now, how long does it take to slaughter a calf?
No time at all. We kill cow all the time on that, and it doesn't get done.
All right, you say no time at all. Give me an hour.
Well, it takes about an hour and a half to clean it up.
That's all it takes from the time you kill it until you get it ready to eat.
Yes, because if you remove the skin fast enough while it's warm, it's easy to tear the skin from the meat. And then you chew off the belly, clean it up, because they don't eat that part.
It just kind of always goes whoosh.
Shut the throat and clean it up.
You had to ask that question.
More information than you wanted.
Well, I'm glad I asked because I'm getting some information I didn't have.
Yeah.
They were supposed to.
I know that because they steal all the cow.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now kosher meat would be different.
Kosher meat have to drain.
Yeah, it would have to drain for a while.
The fresh meat, they kill it and eat it.
So you're saying this is not kosher?
No, not when it's coming from her.
Was that funny?
Chapter 29. Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, while the Israelites were camping by the spring, which is in Jezreel. Aphek was a place in the valley of Jezreel between Mount Tabor and Mount Gilboa. So we're talking about this general area of the valley of Esdraelon.
That's where Eli's sons were killed.
I'm sorry?
That's where Eli's sons were killed. The valley of Aphek.
Sure. both of them. All right, is there any significance in mentioning the spring?
I think it's there for a while, they have water.
I think there's real significance here. They wanted to be near water. That would be very important for the men as they're getting ready to do battle. And the lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were proceeding on in the rear of Achish. Now, who were the lords of the Philistines?
Regional governors or something?
Yeah, these would be the leaders of the five principal cities of the Philistine people. Why were David and his men positioned at the rear of the line of march with Achish?
To protect him.
To protect him, that's right. They were his bodyguards. So they're back there with the king, and Achish really trusts them for his safety. Verse 3, please.
Then the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who has been with me these days, or rather these years, and I have found no fault in him from the day he deserted to me to this day?"
Now, were the commanders different from the lords mentioned in verse 1?
Probably
so. Right, I think so. How would the commanders of the Philistines recognize David and his men as Hebrews? Racial characteristics, probably the way in which they were dressed, probably the kind of weapons that they were using. Were the commanders comfortable with David and his men at the rear of the Philistine army?
No,
they were not. How did Achish defend the position of David and his men? Sure. Achish really trusts in David, and he brings forth his arguments for trusting in him, knowing that he has served him well for over a year now. Verses 4 and 5, please.
But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Make the man go back, that he may return to his place where you have assigned him, but do not let him go down to battle with us, or in the battle he may become an adversary to us. For with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sing in the dances and say, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000?
All right, where did the commanders insist that David and his men go?
Back to Ziklag.
Back to Ziklag, right. What reasoning did the commanders use?
They'll turn on us.
That he would betray them.
Sure. What may be suggested by the last half of verse 5?
He was a good warrior.
His popularity has spread far and wide, hasn't it? They know what kind of a reputation he has.
Saul lasts a long time.
Yeah. Then Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been upright, and you're going out and you're coming in with me, and the army are pleasing in my sight. For I have not found evil in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, you are not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's. Now therefore return and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." Did Achish think highly of David?
Yes,
he certainly did. Was Achish careful how he informed David of the Lord's displeasure?
Yes,
he was. Why would the pagan king say, "As the Lord lives"? I think he's impressing him with his own sincerity in what he's saying to them, and chances are he embraced the God of David along with all the many gods, the idol gods that they had in their group. But he's being courteous to David in not swearing by the name of the Philistine gods. Had the lords been persuaded by the commanders? Probably so. Did Achish try to impress upon David not to insist on his right to go to battle?
Yeah.
I'm sure that he did. David said to Achish, "But what have I done? And what have you found in your servant from the day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" Did David accept Achish's words without further discussion of his matter?
No.
No, he did not. Did David really want to fight against Israel?
No.
No? Then why did he respond the way that he did?
Because if he didn't, some others would have thought, well, yeah, we had a priest to send him home.
Is David walking a pretty fine line here?
Yes.
Was David about to get himself into a real bind?
Yes.
And who's getting him out of it?
The king. Jesus.
Well, God is working providentially in what is happening here. And so it's fortunate for David that it's working out this way, because he was going to be in a real bind. All right, verses 8, 9 and 10, please.
But Achish replied to David, "I know that you are pleasing in my sight like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He must not go up with us to the battle.' Now then, arise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who have come with you, and as soon as you have risen early in the morning and have light, depart."
All right, does Achish repeat his personal satisfaction with David?
Yes.
Yes, this is the third time that he does so. Now, who were the servants of your Lord?
David's men.
Sure, and some people believe that this is referring, by cross reference over in 1 Chronicles 12, 19 through 21, that these were deserters from the tribe of Manasseh that may be identified in this particular way. Verse 11.
So David arose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel.
Did David return to Ziklag when the Philistines went up to Jezreel?
He doesn't say that. He just says they returned to Philistine land.
All right. Is Ziklag in the land of the Philistines?
Yes.
So this would be the logical conclusion to reach then, wouldn't it?
Yes.
What has been the concern of this chapter?
That they'll find out.
Yeah. David is... like I said a moment ago, in a real bind here, and he has to be very, very careful of what he does.
Did the Philistines and the Hebrews share the same language?
I don't know.
They're very similar.
But it would be enough of a dialect that if the lords or commanders, if their physical features weren't so obvious, maybe just hearing them talk too, and there's some Hebrew words.
Regional dialects would.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Philistines were, they came from Mycenaean, or had a Greek ancestry hundreds of years before this. So there were physical differences as well as linguistic differences.
All right. In chapter 30, then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. Wow. Now, what is indicated by the third day?
The length of distance, how far away they were.
That's right. So they have traveled approximately 25 miles each day to get to where they wanted to be at Ziklag. What did David find when he returned to Ziklag with his men?
Burned.
City was burned. Nobody was there at all. What is the Negev? We've talked about that before tonight.
The desert.
All right, that's the desert area to the south. What is implied by raid?
Hit and run.
All right. They'd come and taken everything that they could and then ran away. All right, verse 2.
Captured the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way.
Why was there no one to resist the attack of the Amalekites?
They were all down there.
They were all in military.
That's right. Why did the Amalekites spare the women and children?
Because they could.
Probably to sell them as slaves to the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. They probably realized that they could get some good out of them by disposing them in the south. Verses 3 through 5, please.
When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned. Is that it?
Yes.
Burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. And David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until there was no strength left in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive. And Jezreel Lightis, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal.
All right, what is indicated by the word behold? All right, this indicates a shock that he experienced when they return back home and see what they do. Is the providence of God at work with David and his men at this time? Yes, indeed. This chapter is going to show how God is going to work out things for good, even though it doesn't look that way at this point. Was this a strong emotional experience for David and his men?
Yes.
Certainly was. They wept until they had no strength left. They were totally exhausted. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. For all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Now, what made this a particularly difficult time for David?
Everybody blamed him.
That's right. And the fact that they, you know, what has happened? He doesn't really know yet. And
both sides of the battle turned him away.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes we go to another area, think it's going to be easier for us, and it's not so easy for him yet. That's why I make a comment that David's life is really quite a story. Did the men hold David accountable for all that had taken place? What does the behavior of David's men tell us about them? He didn't have the finest of men character-wise to work with him, did he? Is the behavior of David's men unique?
No.
No, it is not. How was David able to cope at this time? Strength in the Lord. We need to be right with God. How may we compare this crisis of David with that which Saul earlier experienced?
No difference. Saul was terrified, didn't know where to turn. David turned to the Lord.
That's right. Just the very opposite, isn't it?
The world's dumping on you and you got nowhere to go.
That's right. Verses 7 and 8, please.
And David said unto Abiathar, the priest, and the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this man? Shall I overtake them? And he said to him, pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all.
All right, when had Abiathar joined the ranks with David? All right, it was back when David was at Keilah. We read about that back in chapter 22 and again in chapter 23 of 1 Samuel. What request does David make of Abiathar?
Bring your ephod.
That's right. The two stones, the Urim and the Thummim. Had it been some time since David last asked for priestly help? Yeah, not since the rescue at Keilah, where we read about it before in chapter 23 of Samuel. Did David receive some encouraging news when he inquired of the Lord?
Yes.
Surely did. You're going to be rescued. You're going to rescue all of them. How does one turn to the Lord today? That's right. Taking him at his word, believing his promises, and praying and expecting an answer to our prayers. Verses 9 and 10.
So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those left behind remained. But David pursued, he and the 400 men, but the 200 who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor remained behind.
Were David and his men able to take any provisions with them when they left Ziklag? No, there was nothing there for them to get. Did the lack of fresh provisions prevent David from searching for those who had been taken by the Amalekites?
No.
No, because God promised that they would be victorious, and so David, moved by faith, marched ahead. Where was the brook Besor? About 15 miles south of Ziklag. Why did David leave a third of his men at Besor while the others continued to look for their families?
Too
exhausted. Easy to understand that. Now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread and he ate, and they provided him with water to drink. They gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins, and he ate. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. Now, what was this Egyptian doing in the field?
I think he was one of the ones that they took away.
Just too exhausted. He could not move. They left him behind. Did David think this man might be of some help to them?
Yes, he was.
Sure did. Verse 13, 14, please.
David said to him, "To whom do you belong? And where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite. And my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites, and on that which belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire."
All right, who was this man that David found and fed? He's an Egyptian, isn't he? Mm-hmm. A slave of the Amalekites. Did this man hesitate to give David the information he was seeking?
No.
Not at all. What do we learn about the Amalekites from these few verses?
They've been busy.
Not only have they been busy, but they obviously did not have any regard for this sick man. They left him behind just to fare for himself, so they don't have much humanitarian love in their hearts. Could it be that God kept this man alive for David's benefit?
Yes.
Oh, I think so. The Cherethites probably were mercenaries who fought for the Philistines. Then David said to him, "Will you bring me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band." How would this Egyptian be able to lead David to the Amalekites? Yeah, he'd been a part of the group, so he'd heard all their plans. Did the slave fear for his own life if he gave David the information he sought?
Yes,
that's why he asked David to swear under oath that he would deliver him, would not deliver him to the Amalekites, but keep him safe. Does this sound like others than Israelites recognize the importance of an oath in making a promise?
Yes,
it does. How would David and his men be able to catch up with the Amalekites? All right, and when you're moving cattle and sheep and things like that, you don't move all that fast, do you?
And they didn't know they were coming either.
That's exactly right. They had no clue. When he had brought them down, behold, they were spread all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. Who is he who brought them down? Yes, the Lord, obviously, but what man did he use? This Egyptian slave, right. Who is the him who was brought down? David and his men, that's right. We're referring specifically to David. Who are they who were spread over all the land? All right, the raiders, that's true, the Amalekites. Does the fact that the Amalekites were spread over the land make it easier for David and his men to attack them?
No, they're spread out too much.
Sure, if they're spread out so much, why they're not going to work cohesively, I think the answer would be yes. Does it appear that the Amalekites felt secure in the fact that they were scattered and were feasting?
Yes.
Sure. Verse 17, please.
David slaughtered them from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled.
When did David attack the Amalekites?
At twilight.
All right, and this is most commentators suggest this is probably pre-dawn twilight, very early. What indicates the Amalekites offered stubborn resistance?
The length of time it took.
That's right. The fact that the battle continued till the evening of the next day. How may we account for David's victory? Yeah, he's on the Lord's side. God gives his people the victory. Verses 18 through 20, please.
So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives, but nothing of theirs was missing. Whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything they had taken for themselves, David bought it all back. So David had captured all the sheep and the cattle which the people drove ahead of other stock livestock, and they said, "This is David's spoil."
Did David recover all the plunder that had been taken?
Yes,
he did. Were any of the captives missing?
Nope.
No. Does David's spoil mean that it was for him alone?
Not really.
No, he's going to share it with his men, obviously. When David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left at the brook Besor, They went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. Then David approached the people and greeted them. What would have been involved in the greeting?
Lots of joy.
Sure. They're going to be glad to see that their families are being reunited and that victory has been achieved and they've not lost anything. Verse 22, please.
Then all the wicked and the worthless men among those who went with David said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoils that we had recovered, except to every man of his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart.
All right, how does selfishness manifest itself at this time?
Right here.
Greed for the spoils.
That's right. That is so sad. How are the selfish men described?
Worthless.
Worthless and wicked, right. Does this situation present a challenge to David?
Yes.
Yes, it does. He's our leader. He's got to resolve this dispute. Were the wicked and worthless men majority?
No.
Probably not. But their voices were heard. Then David said, you must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hands the band that came against us. And who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. So it has been from the day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. Did David treat the troublemakers respectfully? Yes, he did. Referred to them as his brothers. To whom does David give the credit for the victory over the Amalekites? The Lord. Is David beginning to act like a king?
Yes.
Yes, he is. What statue did David make? Exactly. Verse 26, please.
Now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, I give for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord.
All right, who were the elders of Judah? I'm sorry?
The tribe of leaders.
Okay. Why did David give some of the spoil to the elders of Judah?
He's going to have them on his side eventually.
Yes. That's exactly right, and also to kind of repay them for any losses they may have experienced during all this time. That's true. And David has been depending upon what he could make do during that time of his escape from Saul in this particular area. Was David creating goodwill among the people in the division of the spoil?
Yes.
Yes, he was. All right. We've run out of time, so we'll stop there for tonight. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for your blessing us with this interesting story of a man who has faced so many ups and downs in his life. And yet through it all, he is a man who trusted in you and a man you were able to use. Help us to be careful about making judgments, lest we assume that when things are not going well, that we've been forsaken. Obviously, you were with David all the time. And even in the moments when he did not behave as we would like to have seen him behave, and as you would have liked to see him behave, yet still he maintained a right relationship with you. We thank you for the many psalms that he has written that remind us that he was all too willing to confess his own sins, to acknowledge his own shortcomings, and yet at the same time was willing to be used by you in a way that would honor you. Help us to see the lessons in his life that we can apply to our lives. May we depend upon you, not trusting in ourselves, but in trusting in you. And may we, though we have different talents, use the talents we have to bring an honor and glory to your name. May it be true of each one of us that in word and deed, we just don't say it or we don't do it, unless it is glorifying your name. Dismiss us now with your blessing, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.